Peter Stone.
I'm Peter.
And I'm Felice.
Welcome to our travel podcast. We're specialist travel writers, and we've spent half a lifetime exploring every corner of the world.
So we want to share with you some of our extraordinary experiences and the amazing people we've met along the way.
Hi, everyone, and thank you all for listening to Action Packed Travel. We've now posted over 60 episodes, and of course, we've managed to do this during the weirdest 15-month period in modern world history, when live travel for most of us has been forbidden by law.
From time to time, especially for our more recent listeners, we're going to highlight some of our favourite episodes from the past that we feel are really worth a wider audience. This week, we're travelling back to episode 10, which is a chat with Joanna Hardy. Joanna is one of the world's leading experts on jewellery and precious stones. Million-pound rubies, diamonds and emeralds are her bread and butter.
We started by asking Joanna about her involvement with the BBC TV programme The Antiques Roadshow. Each week, its resident team of experts invite members of the public to bring along their personal treasures to the grounds of a stately home somewhere in Britain to find out what these heirlooms are really worth. These usually include paintings, furniture, and other antiques that they've either inherited or collected, including some truly magnificent multi-million pound jewellery. It's compulsive viewing.
Yes, I've been on the Antiques Roadshow for 14 years now. Every day, you know, when you go on one of these locations, I don't know what I'm going to see or find. I've got absolutely no idea. And of course, the majority of people that are there have no clue either. So it's rather quite nice. I don't know what they're going to bring and they don't know what they have. So that generates huge amounts of excitement. The trouble is when I find something very exciting, is to not give the game away because I don't say anything to anybody until it's on camera. So it's absolutely firsthand because you can't get the general public to go ooh ah twice as enthusiastically as the first time. So you need to have that element of surprise. But sometimes when I even see a box, my heart starts racing because a particular style of box will give me an indication of what might be inside. Often it's not. Often it's just the box and the piece is long gone. But it's very exciting it's hearing people's stories. You know, sometimes the things that don't get filmed, I've seen, you know, some amazing pieces from a story point of view. They might not be worth very much, but I find them very potent. But yes, I have seen such an eclectic mix on the roadshow, which is great. And that's the fun of the Antiques Roadshow.
Now, you started your career in jewellery when you were still in your early teens. You went to Beedale's in Hampshire, which is renowned for its alternative and creative approach to schoolwork.
Well, it was a very creative school. I was very, very lucky that I went to a school where jewellery and making things was as important as being in the chemistry lab. I was very lucky about that because I didn't like the chemistry lab very much and I wasn't very good at it either. So to actually be in this amazing workshop where you could make jewellery, turn wooden bowls. And we had, you know, incredible teachers, very inspiring teachers, and that is what it's all about. And so I very quickly got the bug. When I was 14, I made my first piece of jewellery, and that just sparked an interest, which has never left me ever since then. Then I went up to Sir John Cass College to start a three-year goldsmithing and silversmithing course. And I was living in those prefabs by Three Colts Lane and Valence Road. It was where the craze used to hang out, apparently. And I was in one of these prefabs, these asbestos huts that were left over from the war that they rented out to students for £9 a week. And that's where I stayed for a while. Now, looking back, the East End and that period and time was really very, very interesting. It was quite rough and ready. It's not like it's so gentrified now. I don't recognise the place, but back then it was quite an exciting time.
And if you want to be involved in diamonds, you have to go and work for De Beers at some stage in your career. And that's what you then did.
Yes. I mean, I wasn't very good at making jewellery. I learnt that very quickly. I enjoyed it. And while I was at the Sir John Cass College, I trained as a gemologist. So I learnt gemology in the evenings. And then I worked as a Saturday girl in Hatton Garden. And with that, I then became a full-time sales assistant selling rubbish at the time in Hatton Garden. It was just very uninspiring jewellery. it gave me a living. But I just thought there must be more to this. I loved jewelry. I loved the gemology, but I didn't like the gold chains I was selling. So there's a fruit and veg market behind Hatton Garden called Leather Lane. And I met someone there and they said, oh, De Beers are looking for somebody. Why don't you go and apply? And I said, well, who are De Beers? I've never heard of them. And they said, well, they only own about 90% of the world's diamond mines at the time. And I thought, oh, well, I'll go along. So off I toddled, not knowing very much, went for the interview. And surprise, surprise, I got the job and I became a rough diamond valuer and sorter. And that was an incredible opportunity to discover a world which I knew nothing about. I mean, I had no idea what this world would have led me into, but it was with gems. And there was nowhere else in the world at the time that you could learn to grade and value rough diamonds, because there's 12,000 categories a rough diamond goes into. But as soon as I went there and I heard very quickly of young men coming into the office and going off to learn French because they were going to be buyers in the depths of Africa. And I thought, oh, I want to do that. That sounds ideal. I'd go off to the Congo and Angola and buy all the diamonds that have been smuggled over the borders. And I thought, that's all terribly exciting. Quite fancied that Indiana Jones sort of gung-ho sort of job, but I was a young girl, so that wasn't going to happen. And I quickly realized that it was very much a male world and there was no place for me in the bush buying diamonds for De Beers. So it was then that I just saw an advertisement in the retail jeweler for a polished diamond dealer, an assistant polished diamond dealer in Antwerp. And I thought, well, I don't know anything about polished diamonds, but it's not Africa, it's Antwerp, but it's better than the UK. So I thought I'd apply. And it was the audacity of youth, really. I just sort of went for it. And I didn't realize that actually having worked for De Beers gave me a huge amount of credibility, which I had no idea at the time. And the guy that hired me, he was, you know, he could see that a young girl selling his diamonds in a very orthodox Jewish environment might actually work to his advantage with the wholesalers at the time. So I got the job. I went over to Antwerp in my Ford Fiesta. I rented this flat in the Provinciestraat, just near the zoo, the Antwerp Zoo. And my first day of going down the diamond district and into the office and met the person I was going to be the assistant to, Mr. Nico van Gent. And he threw me a parcel of diamonds and he said, right, sort those into the various categories. And he went away. I looked at this parcel of diamonds and I didn't know where to begin. So I sort of fiddled around with the diamonds. And then he came back and he said, you haven't done anything. And I said, well, I don't actually know what to do. And he said, have they sent me over someone who doesn't know anything? And I sort of nodded my head and said, yes, I'm afraid they have. He said, well, you're here now. I better train you. So I stayed until I was 28 years old, from 21 to 28. I stayed and learnt how to be a diamond dealer. And that was, you know, when I look back, that was incredible because I was on commission. I was a young I'm not Jewish, young girl. During the day, I'd be learning to deal with brokers who were the Orthodox, well, mainly Orthodox Jewish gentlemen, sometimes ladies. But when I was out on the street, I was ignored. You know, I didn't exist. So, but I found the whole thing very fascinating. Antwerp was a great place to live because I very quickly found out there's a whole underground of wonderful music and cafes, and it was a very inspiring place for young people actually at the time. But I was given two patches. I was given Scandinavia as my patch to sell. So in the diamond world, you've got buying areas, which were mainly Antwerp, New York, Tel Aviv, and Mumbai. Those were sort of where the cutting centers were. And then I was given Scandinavia as my patch to go and find the wholesalers and go and sell my diamonds. So I would pack my suitcase. I never carried a briefcase because that all looked a bit obvious. But I used to have just a small bag within a bag full of diamonds, probably, I don't know, about million pounds worth, I suppose, at the time, something like that. They were all samples. And I was a secondhand salesperson. Off I went, and I would go to Helsinki, to all over Sweden, Malmo, Gothenburg, Stockholm. Then I'd go to Norway, to Bergen, Stavanger, Oslo, Denmark. And I would literally get to the hotel, put the diamonds in the hotel safe, go up to my bedroom, look at the yellow pages because there's no mobile phones, there's no internet, and I'd look for diamond wholesalers and I'd phone them up, or diamond manufacturers, that's, you know, people that were making jewellery. And I would phone them up and say, would you like to see some diamonds? and then I'd toddle with my diamonds and show them. And then, because it was all on a carne, so I had to just take the orders. So I took the orders and then went on to the next place. And I would, 3 weeks, I would be on my own. I was 24 years old when I started. And I would, I mean, honestly, I can't believe I did that, really. I certainly wouldn't be doing anything like that now. But it was just, I found it, I didn't even find it that exciting anymore. It was a job. It was a job. And I had to sell diamonds. But quite a few things happened. But one was when, I remember, if I walked into the jewellery shop to collect the stones, because sometimes they would ask me to leave the stones with them so they could show their clients, so they could sell the stones and then give them back to me. And then when I got back to London, I'd ship them. But when they asked me to sit down and have a cup of coffee when I came into the jewellery shop, I knew that something had gone wrong, because they usually would just hand them back to me and then off I'd go. But I knew there was going to be a story attached. And there was one time when I was in Copenhagen and the shop owner sort of sat me down and asked if I wanted a cup of coffee. I went, oh, here we go. And he said, I'm very sorry, but we don't have your diamond. we did have your diamond, but we now don't have your diamond. The person, and not only that, we've been left a deposit for the diamond, which we don't have the diamond, and the money deposit, the money's only printed on one side. Oh. They had no money, they had no deposit, and they had no diamond. So that was quite interesting. But, you know, whenever I went through customs, polished loose diamonds are sort of transparent to x-rays, so no one would see through the x-ray machine that I was carrying diamonds. So I would declare it, obviously, because it was all on a carne and I needed all these stamps. But half the time at, you know, off at customs around the world, they would just take me into a little room because they just want to see a pile of diamonds. So I was very used to customs officers getting very interested only for their own self purposes, really. Yeah, so I would do that. And I used to go to Scandinavia twice a year. Then I'd get the orders. And then I would have to go and buy the orders. So I would go with Henry Jinder, who was the gentleman who owned the company. And I'd go to Tel Aviv and we'd sit there in the diamond bourse buying. Literally, we had a shopping list, which we'd put in the bourse so that the brokers could see what we were looking for. And then they would come to us and then we would look at the parcels and say, yes, we like this, or we like this parcel, but we'll reject this amount. I mean, it was very exciting. And then you had the haggle of price, that always was very exciting, because there would be lots of sort of shouting and how much, and you must be joking, or, you know, speaking on the phone to somebody saying, I know they've offered this price, it's a ridiculous price, and there'd be no one on the other end of the phone. It would all be a bit of a show and a shebang. But, you know, you all knew that. But when a deal was struck, you would just say mazal. There was no handshake, there was nothing written. It was a word, it is my bond. And that was how the diamond business conducted itself. And I've always, to this day, the word is my bond is always, it's harder to find, but that's always been the way that diamond dealing was done. I mean, it's a very closed world. And so everybody, there's a lot of trust that's built up and a lot of respect and reputation. And, you know, a reputation can be destroyed very quickly if someone does something wrong, you know, because it's a very small world. And it certainly was a small world then.
And the money printed on one side, did you get the diamonds back?
No, I didn't get the sample back. there was another time when I was in Stavanger, and I had the diamonds in my bag, and I just put them up on the locker above in the plane when I was on the plane. So I was flying from Oslo to Bergen, but there was a stopover at Stavanger, and I didn't realize that when we stopped in Stavanger to wait for the next lot of passengers to come on board, that it was the changeover of the oil rigs, which is about every 6 weeks or 8 weeks, they would change the workers. And of course, they haven't seen alcohol for about 8 weeks. And all these Swedish men came on board the plane, and I never engaged in conversation with anybody when I was on these trips. I just wanted to keep myself to myself. So I was just sitting there with a book, and this guy came and sat next to me, went, "Hello." And he was speaking English because you could see I was reading an English book. And I just sort of tried to ignore him or something. Anyway, all the beer was flowing, all the alcohol was flowing. And then he was saying, I was only 24, 25 years old. And he was saying, "So what are you doing?" You know, I said, "Oh, I'm on holiday." "Oh, are you going to Bergen?" "Yes, I'm going to Bergen." And then he started chatting, and I tried to sort of ignore him. Anyway, so he said, "Yes, I'm on holiday." And then he said, "So how are you getting from Bergen to where are you staying?" And I said, "Well, I'm staying at the SAS hotel," which, of course, why would a 25-year-old stay in an SAS hotel in Bergen on her own as a holiday? It's a bit weird. I like the SAS hotel. He said, "How are you getting there?" And I said, "Oh, I'm going by the SAS courtesy bus." And he said, "No, I'll take you there. I've got some mates, they're picking us up. We'll take you to Bergen." And I just thought in my head, "No, you won't. You're not taking me to Bergen." So, it was quite a short trip to Stavanger. When we got to Bergen, I mean, Bergen has a big airport, but when I was traveling around there, there was a hut. It was just literally a hut, because I thought, well, I'll lose them at Bergen Airport and they'll forget about me and they'll all go off. But when I got to Bergen Airport, it was a shack. And I just thought, oh, goodness, I was walking really slowly, and I had to go and declare my diamonds to customs, and I didn't want them to, why am I going behind a curtain in customs? And it was literally a curtain anyway. So just before you collect your luggage, you have to go through nothing to declare. And of course, I have to go through the declare channel, and I thought I'd lost them. So I was doing everything very slowly. And I thought, well, hopefully the customs officer here will get all excited about diamonds and will want to look at them all, and I'll be there ages. But quite to the contrary, because the plane was late, he wanted to get home and he didn't give a monkey's what I was carrying. So he just stamped my carnet, and I was out of the curtain in 2 seconds. And there was just a conveyor belt that stopped about, 12 feet down with your suitcases. And that was that. And I could see the SAS courtesy bus at the car park. And it was, it was at night now. So I grabbed my case. I thought, oh, they've all gone. Thank goodness. And I rushed on the bus, sat down. I thought, oh, I'm safe now. And then I heard the chap going, "We're going to take you to Bergen. Are you not traveling on this bus?" And so he took my luggage and took it off across the car park to his car with his girlfriend and some other mates. Oh, my goodness. So there's me with my handbag running with the diamonds on me, running across the car park to chase after my suitcase. And they wanted to put my handbag into the boot of the car. And I went, no, I like my handbag with me. "No, it's fine. It's safe in the boot." I said, "No, I really like to have my handbag with me," because we were all scrunched up at the back, and out came the beers, out came the joints. And I just thought, oh my goodness me, how am I going to explain this to my boss when they'll all work out that, or find out that I'm actually carrying £1 million worth of loose diamonds on me? And anyway, I have never had my heart in my mouth like that again. I was just petrified, not of just, what could happen. My mind was just racing. But, they were as good as their word. They dropped me off at the SAS hotel in Bergen and said, "Well, enjoy your holiday." And I said, "Yeah, I will now. Thank you very much."
So how did you move on from diamonds to other gems?
So I was in the diamond world, and I loved, as much as I loved it, I got a phone call from Phillips the Auctioneers, who are now Bonhams, and they wanted a diamond specialist, and would I consider working for them? And I just thought, well, that's interesting. I know absolutely nothing about antique jewellery. So I remember when I was in Antwerp, I'd go over to Zeebrugge just before the interview. I'd go over, to London, cross a ferry, and sit in the V&A or the British Museum jewellery galleries to try and learn about antique jewellery before my interview, so I could sound vaguely knowledgeable when I got to the interview. So anyway, I did that, got the interview, got the job, and stayed at Philip for, the Philip's son and Neil it was then, and it was a wonderful training ground of learning about antique jewellery and gemstones in general. But I think I had the bug of travelling for my work, and I just, that's always been, I've always wanted travel to be integral to my business and my work, and I've been so, so lucky to have managed to do that. I've been to countries and places and people that I never, ever would have imagined I would have got to see. It's not so much the countries, well, it's the countries, but it's the people. It's the people and the country, the experiences. That's what makes it special. And I love the natural world. And so flying around in Colombia or crossing the Gibb River Road or going down the Gibb River Road in Australia to the Argyle Mines. I mean, just Myanmar. I loved Burma. Madagascar, I thought that was just beautiful country. And the people were lovely. Well, the people everywhere are lovely, actually. I must say, on all my trips and my travels, they've been very welcoming. And I've really loved, engaging with different cultures. When I was with Philips, I then was asked to go to India to look for mogul jewellery to sell in the Geneva sales. And I just thought I'd gone to heaven. Someone was paying for me to go to India. I was travelling around in a rickshaw, popping into jewellers and looking at mogul jewellery and trying to get them to sell them in Geneva. I mean, this is years ago. It's not quite that simple anymore. But those were the days when, to combine my love of jewellery and also learning about all the different types of jewellery that all these different cultures would have and all the different stones and all their different meanings. It's very individual, all these loves and passions. Since I left, I was with Sotheby's for 14 years, and I was an auctioneer and a senior jewellery specialist for them. Since leaving Sotheby's, which was 11 years ago now, I have had the very good fortune of working with Gemfields, who are a mining company, and they're sort of like De Beers of the coloured stone world, and they have sponsored a book on emerald and a book on ruby, which I have written, and I'm just embarking on writing a book on sapphires, and that has given me an incredible excuse to go and travel and see all these countries and all the mining areas. I love to be able to see where things have started and where they finish. So I work very closely with Van Cleef & Arpels and Cartier and all the archivists in Paris, and of course the new jewellery that's being made now. So for me to be able to actually see where it's come from, meet the people who trade in those stones, meet the people that cut those stones to end up in Place Vendôme, I find so fascinating. And a piece of jewellery is about a group of people have put it together. It's not just one person. It's been nature. It's then been man with nature. It's then been the traders. And then it's been the goldsmiths, the designers. And then you've got the custodians, which are the people who own those jewels. But they'll only own those jewels for a period of time before they either pass it on to somebody else. So it's a journey that involves a lot of people and skills, a lot of skills that have been handed down through generations. When I was in Burma or Myanmar, I travelled, it's about 7 hours north of Mandalay, an area called Mogok. And I, in fact, bought a piece of rough ruby, very small but a rough one, from what's called the Kanazé women. Then I got it cut, and the person that cut it, his father and his grandfather were ruby cutters. It's been a tradition all through their lives, and they're very proud of it. Then I've met one of the biggest ruby dealers in Thailand, but he also cuts his own stones. And so when I showed him my ruby that had been cut for someone in Burma, in Mogok, there was suddenly, and I showed in the video of how they cut the stone, because it's very different to how other people cut stones. It's very unique to Myanmar. There was such a, you know, this guy who's very big in the ruby world and is worth lots of money, but his passion for the subject, there was this camaraderie, this mutual respect for the person in Myanmar. And it didn't matter. It didn't matter, you know, the language. It didn't matter about money. It was all beyond that. It was understanding each other's skill set. That's what I find so beautiful, is it? And when you've got people with passion, they will really strike up this very unique relationship with other people who have similar skills in other parts of the world. So that's very important. But, you know, there's no way that I would pick up a stone normally. I don't buy stones. That I did as a sort of a one-off. When you're near a mine, you do not pick up anything. You do not pick up a pebble. You do not pick up anything, because if they think you've picked up a stone that might be worth something, I think you would. I think you would very quickly have a lot of people strip searching you. So, I stay well clear. I have my hands always. I show that I've got absolutely nothing as I walk out of a mine. So, you know, everyone knows that all the stones there are safe, if there are any.
You had an interesting experience at an emerald mine in Colombia.
Yes, Colombia is an astonishing country. I flew to Bogota. I was actually giving a talk on emeralds. And then I had the opportunity to go and see an emerald mine, Cosquest, which is owned by a company called Fura. I drove there, took about 7 hours. It was quite a rough road. And I stayed on the mine for a few days, and that was incredible. The landscape was just something else. I had never seen such beauty. The owner of the mine, he said, well, because it was time for me to go back, and so it was like a 7 hour journey back down. Or he said, well, you can go back in a helicopter, which would take like 15 minutes or something like that. And I just thought, oh my goodness, a helicopter. I'm not a very good flyer, even though I fly all over the place. I'm not a very good flyer. I'm definitely not a good flyer in helicopters. But 15 minutes versus 7 hours. And I looked at the countryside and I just thought, my goodness, I can't miss this opportunity. And so I did go in the helicopter, and I just thought, if I drop out of this plane, out of this helicopter and die, this would be a very good place to do it in, because it was just stunning. And the green hills and the mountains and the vegetation was just so green. And to think that there were all these emeralds underneath these mountains, that was what was so sort of just nature. You know, nature's got these green stones beneath, which hadn't seen, some of them have not seen, a lot of them have not seen the light of day for over 50 million years. Just majestic. I think that's one of the best trips I have done. I won't be getting in a helicopter anytime soon. I think that is a very good one to leave on.
By definition, because of the extraordinary high value of gems, your job has a substantial element of danger attached to it. Do you ever think your life is threatened?
Yes, it can be, because there is a lot of money at stake. The material you find in mines is very low grade. You know, to think that you're going to go to a mine and then you'll find a fantastic ruby, people can wait years before they can find one of those. So that's a nice thing on the cake. We do get a little bit blasé when we see these amazing stones in Bond Street shops or something like that. But I can tell you it has taken years to get a collection together. The world is not a supermarket. The majority of stones are very low grade, and the icing on the cake are some of these very amazing stones. But nevertheless, there is money. You have to be very careful, because whenever there's money to be made, that's always going to attract unsavory characters. And so it is very important that you go with the right people and you do your own due diligence. I do my own due diligence. I will always check who the people are, check quite a few people who know those people that I am going to be safe with. And there are times, yes, when you do have to, you know, be under armed guard, you know, but that's, I suppose that's more of a precautionary measure than anything else. There was a time when I've just come back from Madagascar. There is no large-scale mining there for sapphires. It's all sort of artisanal mining. I was with two geologists and also someone that lives in Madagascar. And I had also a local Madagasy gentleman too, both of who have been there all their lives, obviously, and know the tribes well, know they have a great reputation and they're very trusted. And going around with them was better than any gun because they had that respect from the local miners and the local tribes people. We traveled about 7 hours of off-road. And then we ended up at this village. We were sitting in this sort of mud hut. It was really hot. They knew that we wanted to look at the sapphire mines and they wanted to know more about us. But the fact that we had this guy, Mark, with us, he was our insurance policy. They had heard of him. They had respect for him. They knew him. They agreed to take us to the sapphire mines, which was another 3 kilometer trek. We did have an armed guard. They did have one of their guards go with us who had a gun. But I sort of told myself that was more for the crocodiles in the river than for us. Because whenever we met any miners, they were all lovely people. But you do have to be careful and very sensitive to the environment that you're in and to the people that you're going to see. And remember that it's their country, not yours. And I think that is absolutely paramount when traveling.
You once did a valuation in the turrets of a castle.
Yes, I mean, there's all sorts of funny places you end up valuing people's jewellery. And when I was at Sotheby's, I went to a castle in Scotland. It's always people that seem to live in very small houses. They're the ones that are the most hospitable and they'll make you a cup of tea and give you a piece of cake and it's lovely. The bigger the house... the less you get, you're very lucky to get even a dog biscuit. I went to this castle and they said, oh yes, we'll just go up to the turret. And I just thought, why are we going up to the turret? because they couldn't afford to heat the place. And she said, oh, it's warmer, heat rises and it's warmer in the turret than it is down below. So I sat in this turret with literally, if I had a biscuit, I was lucky, valuing this jewellery. So often, you find yourselves in situations. There was another castle or something like that, similar, that I went to. And this lady, it took her quite a while to find her jewellery. She kept forgetting where she'd put it because she'd hidden it everywhere. So eventually she'd found it and then she brought it out to me. And then she would say, oh, where's that? Where's my diamond ring? Now, why is that not here? And then she worked out that her husband had taken a few bits before the divorce. So you do find yourselves sometimes in tricky situations. I've always said that valuing jewellery is sort of 30% knowledge and 70% counselling. Because you must always work out why do they want it valued, what their expectations are. I think that's managing people's expectations.
And now in lockdown, now you can't travel. Can you still do your work?
Yes, I can. It was quite interesting because I'm writing this book on sapphires. I've been phoning up these amazing private collectors all over the world. I mean, yesterday I was speaking to a sapphire miner's wife. She was in the outback in the 70s and her husband was a miner. And so she was telling me about her experiences in Australia in the outback during the 70s. And that was absolutely fascinating. And then in the afternoon, I was speaking to someone in LA who was a private collector. And I just thought, this is brilliant. I've been to Australia and Los Angeles all in a space of a morning. And usually with these, I've been speaking to people in Japan and Puerto Rico and New York and I mean, all over the place. They would normally be in their private jets all over the place and wouldn't have time to speak to me. So I've got a captive audience at the moment. I think everyone's sick of talking about the virus. And if you can talk about their jewellery collection, they love it. So I've had these amazing conversations, very inspirational conversations with people. And so I feel like I'm still travelling, actually. I don't feel I've stopped, which is great.
And you're also running an online jewellery foundation course.
Yes, I've got this jewellery foundation course. It's on the platform of learningwithexperts.com. So you can also learn about making bread and gardening and photography and all of those things. And you can also learn more about jewellery, if just out of interest. So my course is 8 one-hour videos about rubies, emeralds, pearls, sapphires, diamonds. It talks about the antique and the contemporary, the fakes, what I look for. We go to the assay office about hallmarking. We go to diamond cutters, enamelers. So that's me engaged in conversation with all these various artisans and dealers and all the people that make up the jewelry world. So there's two levels. There's one level where you can pay and just watch the one, all the 8 1-hour videos. Or there's another level where you watch the same videos, but I've set some tasks, which you can do in lockdown. You don't have to go anywhere. But then I mark it. So it's up to you which one you do. But I highly recommend them, of course.
Sounds great.
Joanna, you once said that you're at your happiest in the wild around a campfire with your family and a glass of wine in your hand. Is that right?
Absolutely. My husband was a park ranger in Australia. I was in Girl Guides. So I think the Girl Guides started that off.
And you once travelled from Sydney to Cape York at the very tip of northern Queensland.
Yes, that was Sydney to Cape York. And that was in a two-wheel drive Chevy truck with three guys. That was when I was travelling around Australia. I took a very late gap year in the 90s. And it was supposed to be 6 months, but it ended up being 2 years. But on this particular trip, we lived off the land from Sydney to Cape York. And we did about 10 creek crossings a day. And I was charged by razorback pigs. And we had bushfires. And we had snakes. And we had a horrible, taipan. A taipan snake sort of suddenly got lost in the engine of the Chevy truck, and all these amazing journeys, and we were eating green ants and making dampers, and I'd never been happier. It was absolutely amazing. We also fished for Saratoga and Barramundi in the mangrove swamps up at the top, and then we went to Punson Bay, and we had our little rubber ducky. We called it a rubber ducky, sort of inflatable boat, which we went off into the mangrove swamps, and we would tie. Ended up being my husband, but at the time he was just it was a mate, and he would be tying red string on the trees, because when you would come back the waterways, you'd get completely lost because it would look very different on your return. So we would follow our red ribbons on the way back so that we could find our truck. They took that boat over to Thursday Island, and I said, I'm getting an Aboriginal ferry. There's no way I'm crossing the Torres Straits in an inflatable boat. You've got to be nuts. So I went over to Thursday Island on this Aboriginal ferry boat, and that was all amazing because I saw the pearl farms and everything like that, and got back. And the boys went off on their little adventure. And it was in the evening when the palm trees were bending double through the storms, and there was none of these guys came back. I just thought, oh my goodness, I was stuck on Punson Bay on my own in this truck. So I drove off to the nearest Aboriginal outpost and raised an alarm that there was three young men in a rubber ducky somewhere bobbing about in the Torres Straits in a storm. So in the morning, they did sort of send out search parties, and they did actually find them. They managed to just get the corner of Thursday Island in the mangrove swamps, which was full of crocodiles. I mean, how they had to have a fire, they had to keep a fire going to ward off all the crocodiles. They arrived back on the beach, and that was when Craig and I suddenly ran towards each other and hugged each other. And I just thought, where's that come from? Anyway, he's now my husband, so that's that.
And then you rode Apache horses across Monument Valley on the Arizona-Utah border.
Well, that was amazing. I used to always go horseback riding, and in fact, our honeymoon was we went off around Calgary, and we did the grizzly bear route. And we had about 5 pack horses. There was 5 of us. And we had this wonderful lady who was our leader, who was called Anna Fontana. And Anna Fontana was an owner of a ranch. And she was our leader. And for 3 weeks, we just went through all grizzly bear country, which was really quite extraordinary. It was a wonderful experience. And yes, and we took the kids a few years ago. We went off in our RV, traveling around America. And you know, you've seen these old cowboy films with them galloping through Monument Valley. And I just thought, wow, you know, being chased by the Red Indians, Apaches, or, you know, so I just thought, oh, that would be an amazing to see Monument Valley area. And there was an opportunity to ride horses. And I just thought, we can't miss this. So we did. We went riding off, the 4 of us, in the sunset on Apache horses around Monument Valley during the sunset. And that was, again, another magical, magical moment. My husband is a very good horse rider. He was off all over the place, but I was a little bit more reserved. But it was great. Absolutely amazing.
And finally, what's the most beautiful, the best, most beautiful gem or piece of jewellery you've ever seen?
Well, they're usually when they're a complete surprise. When I was at Phillips, I didn't really just... been out of the gemology classroom, I suppose, only about 5 years or so. It's always handy if you look older to give people bad news. It's not very good to look young and give people bad news, because they think, you know, what do you know? You've been doing it for 5 minutes. So this lady came into Phillips and she showed me a ruby, and I looked at it and I could instantly tell that it was a synthetic. Anyway, I asked her what did she think she had, and she said, oh, we've had it in the family for years and we now need the money, and so I want to sell it so that we can distribute it around the family. And you know, she had obviously quite high expectations of this ruby, and I just thought, oh my goodness, what am I going to tell her? So I went behind the scenes to look it through the microscope just to double check that my gut feeling was right, and it was. So I invited her into the small room. We had a small room for private clients or when you need some privacy. I offered her a glass of water. I thought I should really be offering you a gin and tonic. I think you'll want a gin by the time I've finished talking to you. I sat down and I eventually said, look, I'm really sorry, but this ring is synthetic. And it's not, you know, it's worth about £5. And she just said, oh, I knew that. I was just testing you. So I just thought, what? after what you've put me through. Anyway, so off she went. And then she came back 2 weeks later with 2 5-carat diamonds. And I think at the time I said they were about £50,000 each or something like that. And she just sort of nodded and went, okay, and left again. And I thought, you have got something. You are just checking me out. Then I got a phone call and she said, would you have tea with me in Brown's, the hotel in Albemarle Street in London? And so off I toddled and sat there with her. And she was an Indian princess. And she was, I remember her in these wonderful, colourful saris. She said, I want you to fly with me to my vaults. She said, I knew I was drawn to you for a reason. And I said, oh, okay. That's very nice. So I went back to the office and I just said to my boss, I'm going to someone's vaults in Geneva next week. Is that okay? And he said, would you like to have a guard with you? And I went, no, probably best not, because she doesn't seem to like, you know, any too much sort of exposure. So off I flew, went to Geneva and opened the vaults. And there was the real ruby ring. There was also a beautiful pair of Art Deco Cartier emerald drop ear pendants, a beautiful ruby and diamond deco bracelet, and this amazing pink diamond, which was the size of my thumbnail, and it was an emerald cut, bright candy floss pink. And I just never seen anything like this in my life. And she wanted me to value it. And I thought, well, I haven't got the first clue. So I phoned a friend, as you do. So I phoned a colleague of mine who was in Geneva and I said, would you mind coming over here? Because I've got something to show you. So he came over and we had a look at it and we thought, probably going to be, it was an educated guess of about £2 million, which is in 1992. I mean, this was, you know, that was a lot of money for a pink diamond, and certainly felt like a lot of money for us to quote on. And she said, oh, that's lovely. Well, you can sell it then. And I went, okay. So we did eventually. Well, then I went on my walkabouts. In fact, we didn't sell it until I came to Sotheby's. And she then sold it at Sotheby's. And it went for $6.2 million. And it was the world record price for a pink diamond at the time. And often people say, what would you like to see again? Or, you know, and I would love to see this 7.37 carat. I will never forget the weight of the stone in a Cartier mount, beautiful pink diamond. The nearest I've seen that pink color is in the Queen has the Williamson pink brooch that she sometimes wears with a very large pink diamond in it. And that's about as close to the color that I have ever seen. So that would be lovely to be able to see again. But that's obviously hopefully being enjoyed by someone, whoever that might be. What was lovely when working at Sotheby's, you know, you went to all over the world. I valued the most amazing collections, private collectors. You would also go on spec. You would just go and sit in an office, or you would put an advertisement out and get replies from the advertisement. And then you would go off and see these people in their homes. And this happened once in the Channel Islands. My colleague and I, we went round the houses replying to the advertisements. We'd go into their homes and they'd show us the jewelry, and we would give them sort of an idea of how much we think the pieces would make in auction. We went to this one place, and this lady had a whole load of gold, just loads of just gold jewelry, which was really just sort of scrap value. And then she handed me this ring, and it was absolutely filthy. I mean, I could hardly see it. It was just absolutely filthy. And she said, oh, this used to be my mother-in-law's, and just wondered what you thought. And it was a square stone. It was blue. It was the size of my thumbnail. And she said a jeweler thought it might be a topaz or an aquamarine. Anyway, she really did like talking. She just talked and talked and talked and talked and talked at you. I think she was just very pleased to see somebody because she lived on her own. Anyway, she talked a lot. In between that time, I said, do you have an old toothbrush? And could I just use your sink and some fairy liquid or some soap so I can clean the ring? So I went into her kitchen, she was still talking at me, and I started to clean her ring. Obviously, I put the plug in the sink. that's always you always do that when you're cleaning any jewelry. You always make sure the plug is in the sink. And as she was talking, and I was cleaning and cleaning, as I was cleaning it, it was getting bluer and bluer. I looked at it with my loupe, and it was a blue diamond. I just turned around to her and I said, this is worth about £1 million. And she stopped talking. it was silence. And I thought, oh, I should have said that earlier. She would have stopped talking earlier. Anyway, she was absolutely gobsmacked, had no idea. So she said, oh, well, you better sell it then, please. So I walked out with this blue diamond worth £1 million. And I had to get it to Geneva. And it was suddenly you feel like you've got sort of a sign across your face, you know, sort of saying, mug me now, I'm worth £1 million. Though I'm never, ever, that is all a long time ago. It's a very different world now. No one walks anywhere with anything anymore. But it was just very funny at the time. And it's just wonderful to discover things that when people had no idea themselves of what they had.
So, Joanne Hardy, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been great talking to you.
Oh, well, thank you very much for allowing me to indulge and, you know, remember all my wonderful adventures. I hope to have lots more.
You can find out more about Joanna, her jewellery courses, and her books on precious stones on her website, joannahardy.com.
That's all for now. If you've enjoyed the show, please visit our website, actionpacktravel.com, or you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, or any of the many podcast platforms. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'd love you to sign up for our regular emails too at peter@actionpacktravel.com. Until next week, stay safe.